Conservation is a critical component to revitalizing the rural economy. It is also obvious that it's critical to maintaining the capacity of American agriculture to be productive in the face of changing climates and additional weather conditions. That's why I'm really proud of the work that Jason and his team have been doing at NRCS in terms of obtaining record enrollment in programs, focusing on landscape-scale efforts, soil health campaigns, water quality initiatives, working with programs such as the Working Lands for Wildlife, the National Water Quality Initiative, the Wood-to-Energy efforts, and the Centennial Landscape Initiative we announced not long ago. One of the critical components, though, for us to maintain our edge in conservation is for us to continue to be innovative. And innovation will be key to managing the capacity to adapt and mitigate to climate changes. It will be key to us continuing to learn and to expand on our soil health campaign. It will be the foundation upon which our ecosystem market effort will be built. And it obviously is critically important to water quality. The Farm Bill basically in the past has provided us tools in which to further our conservation efforts. And in the 2008 Farm Bill, it created the Conservation Innovation Grant Program. Since that time, Jason and his team have instituted 266 grants, including the announcements that we're going to make today. It's generated about $200 million of investment by USDA, which has leveraged an additional $200 million by the private sector and landowners. So $400 million being invested in innovation. Last year when we were faced with a serious drought, it was the Conservation Innovation Grant Program earlier this spring that created opportunities for us to look at ways, creative ways to deal with drought. We announced 13 projects and $5 million in funding. Today, we complement that effort and add to it by making announcements of 33 new awards, totaling $13.3 million of NRCS resources. In addition to these awards, we're also giving our states opportunities to set aside 5% of their EQIP allocation to fund smaller grant programs of up to $75,000, and 27 states are doing just that. Let me give you two examples of the power of this Conservation Innovation Grant Program, and then I'd like to turn it over to Jason for additional details. I'm excited about a multi-state effort in which we have entitled the Conservation Technology Information Center, which is really going to focus on providing information to expand on the benefits that cover crops can provide. The economic benefits to landowners, the environmental benefits that can accrue, as well as the crop production and ag management benefits that can accrue from cover crop production. This is an important tool for us to retain precious water resources, to replenish and re-nourish the soil, and to potentially over time create new market opportunities for landowners, farmers, ranchers, and producers. This award will basically fund roughly 1,000 acres that will help us hopefully dispel some of the myths that may be in the countryside that have discouraged producers from focusing on cover crop production. Complementing that award is an award to the University of Tennessee. They will take a look at longer-term impacts of cover crops and of other soil health techniques, from crop rotations to conservation tillage. You know, this is going to be important information that we'll obtain from these innovative grant recipients and will help to educate and to assist us in the future in terms of conservation programs. Critically important, though, is the ability to continue this type of activity, which means that we must have Congress complete its work on a farm bill this year. We've waited too long. The uncertainty creates a degree of concern whether conservation programs will continue, whether programs will be adequately financed, and whether or not key innovations can continue to be financed through this Conservation Innovation Grant Program. So again, this is yet another reason, on top of disaster assistance, on top of solving the Brazilian cotton issue, on top of providing certainty of what the safety net will be for producers, that Congress must and should act quickly to resolve the differences between various bills, get a conference committee started, get House members appointed, get them in a room, and get this job done. With with that, I want to turn it over to Jason. And again, he and his team have done a remarkable job of embracing conservation, encouraging landowners to do so, which is why we have record enrollments. Jason.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I, too, am really excited about today's announcement and the release of these 33 grants, the total $13 million in additional funding on top of the drought assistance we issued this year. But I'd like to talk just a little bit about the CIG program, the Conservation Innovation Grants Program, just to give a real very brief background on what it's about. In many respects, we view ourselves as almost the publicly funded venture capitalists of conservation, where we partner up with private companies, nonprofit organizations, conservationists, state and local units of government, soil and water conservation districts, universities, and together we leverage our expertise and our dollars to go out and really try new innovative approaches and technologies to try and raise the bar on our conservation and how we're providing service to farmers, ranchers, and forest landowners to help their bottom line, their economic bottom line, to help the bottom line in those rural communities, but then also help those who live in the airshed or in the watershed or living down the river who need those clean water resources, clean air resources. So together we're really helping to stimulate and accelerate delivery of new approaches for conservation through this program. With this year's group, you've already highlighted two really good, excellent projects. There are a couple others I would just like to raise up and highlight as well. I know it's been a priority for you, Mr. Secretary, in terms of trying to provide enhanced access to USDA assistance. And there's an excellent project here we have with the U.S. Endowment for Forestry and Communities. And this is a project where we're working in the southeastern part of the United States, specifically in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Alabama. And the endowment is going to be then partnering with minority-owned forest lands, African-American forest land owners in the southeastern United part of the United States. And in these lands, the land conversion and land loss is impacting not just these rural communities, but these private landowners. And with the conversion from these timbered lands to non-timber uses, it not only is impacting those families, but it's also impacting the economies of those local communities, but also the other benefits those forests provide. You know, wildlife habitat for both at-risk species, but also for game species, clean water, and just the quiet enjoyment of a forest landscape. So the endowment's going to be working with private landowners to both do estate planning, then also conservation planning. The estate planning is crucial. So we're then providing good, clear land ownership so that those landowners can then partner with USDA and get access to USDA assistance. It makes it much easier and cleaner for those families to engage with us. We can then, in turn, get on their lands and do good conservation planning. And at the end of the day, we're helping their bottom line in terms of those families getting good, healthy timber production so they can then enjoy not only the use of their lands but also timber production, so it's a good economic benefit. We're improving the resource stewardship of those forests, so you're providing improved water quality and wildlife habitat, and you're overall providing improved economic success for those communities. So it's a triple bottom line. Another project I want to just specifically highlight is specifically talking in the southern part of the Mississippi River Basin, and this is with the White River Irrigation District. And so the irrigation districts are working in Arkansas, Missouri, Mississippi, and Louisiana. And 75% of the rice in this country is grown in that part of the country. So there are 2.5 million acres of rice production in that part down in the lower Mississippi River Valley. So the White River Valley District, Irrigation District, they're come up with an innovative approach. How do we use some alternative ways of growing rice that is less water intensive, also less intensive on nutrient use? So you're going to have more efficient use of both the nutrients and water, but they're also putting in some really sophisticated tracking tools, such as automated satellite imagery technologies, so we can track water use and soil moisture, and they're putting together a registry to track farmer decision-making and water use, but also on the off-gassing of greenhouse gases like methane. So they will then be able to provide a producer tools. A producer can go into the open market and sell carbon credits to buyers of credits in California. So here's a way where the agriculture community is stepping up, and through some innovation, we're providing more efficient use of water and nutrients. We're helping to maintain or actually increase rice yield, which is very important for world food production, but then also helping to address one of your also priorities, climate change.
Jason, thank you very much. A lot of exciting opportunities here, and looking forward to seeing the results of all these projects. Susan, with that, if there are questions, the two of us will be happy to try to answer them.
Okay. Well, once again, I will invite those who want to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone to do so. And I'm going to start off we're still struggling with drought, and that's been a major issue. How do the conservation innovation grants work in conjunction with the efforts that come out of the Farm Bill to actually help farmers do this?
Well, earlier in the year in April, we announced a series of conservation innovation grants that were really focused on drought. And one of the examples was, I believe it was in Missouri, the University of Missouri or Tennessee, focusing on grazing and cattle operations that would create a less intensive, water-intensive grazing opportunities. So we are essentially challenging the rest of agriculture, and I think Jason's analogy of venture capital is a good one. These are ideas perhaps that have never been thought of before, never tried before, or maybe are in their infancy with a little additional resource can basically become legitimate strategies for producers to deal with. Cover crops clearly have a benefit in terms of retention of water resources, which is why we're putting a lot of emphasis on the cover crops in this round of awards.
But to that, Mr. Secretary, it's just been another opportunity to highlight both what we issued earlier this year, but then also another proposal that we are going to be funding with this announcement. It's specifically working with the Oklahoma Black Historical Research Project, which is going to be focused on tribal lands in Oklahoma. And so here we're specifically looking at how do we improve, again, water use efficiency, in this case with tribal members, on their agricultural lands, and long-term helping them adapt to a drier climate or to drought situations, like installing solar pumps and helping them adopt culturally appropriate cultural practices on their operations so they can better withstand and be more resilient to drought or other periods of extreme weather.
We've got a caller on the line. Let's go first with Amanda Paterka, and she is with Greenwire. Amanda, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for taking my question. Mr. Secretary, you mentioned the importance of Congress completing its work on the Farm Bill. I was hoping if either you or Jason could be a little bit more specific of what happens come October 1st if we don't have a Farm Bill. If Congress allows it to expire for a few months like last year, what does that do to USDA's ability to help farmers and ranchers put in place conservation practices on their land?
Well, the immediate impact after October 1st on conservation is not the concern at this point. We still would have resources, still have projects based on 2008 Farm Bill and the announcements yet to be made and resources yet to be allocated. Where there is a problem is other aspects of the Farm Bill, the failure to resolve the Brazilian cotton case, which could result in retaliatory measures from Brazil against our agricultural products. The lack of a disaster assistance program for these drought-stricken livestock producers who are really struggling after 2 years and potentially a third year of drought. The opportunity that Congress could essentially take resources out of the existing farm programs, i.e. direct payments, and not provide a sufficient flexibility or allow reinvestment of some of those savings back into a new Farm Bill, which would make it even more difficult to get a Farm Bill passed. Now, long term, obviously the authority and the ability to continue investing in conservation is directly related to the passage of a five-year program. Jason's team needs, as well as the landowners and farmers and ranchers and producers of this country need, the certainty of knowing what the programs are going to be and what the levels of appropriation are going to be. Absent a Farm Bill, they do not have that certainty, and that makes it very difficult for Jason and his team at NRCS to do the planning. It makes it virtually impossible for landowners to make decisions about their operations long term, and what it basically does is it creates a serious risk of making the wrong decision, so as a result, people don't make any decisions. And things stall. That means that we won't be able to build on the foundation of record involvement in conservation. We won't be able to advance the ecosystem market development that could provide additional private sector investment in conservation. We won't be able to expand on the Working Lands for Wildlife program that has been so popular in providing some degree of regulatory certainty with endangered species and water certification programs. We won't be able to continue to invest in the National Water Quality Initiative that's focused on smaller watersheds or the landscape scale collaborative efforts that are located and focused on larger major water bodies like the Great Lakes, the the Upper Mississippi River Basin, the California Bay Delta, the Chesapeake Bay, the Gulf Coast. These are all areas that we can focus time and attention and resources on, but we have to know what the programs are, and we have to have the certainty of the funding.
Let's continue with our callers on the line from DTN, Chris Clayton. Chris.
Thank you for taking my call. Amanda took most of my questions, Secretary, and these look like really good projects, but kind of focusing on the Farm Bill again at the moment. Are you guys going to be, is the administration going to be amenable to some sort of short-term extension to after September 30th, because with only 9 or 10 working days, I guess, left in this month?
Well, first of all, the rest of us see September apparently differently than the members of Congress do. I think it, what is today, September 10th? If I'm correct, that means there are 20 days left in September, so a lot of us will be working more than 9 days in the remaining part of September. Congress might try that, might try working on Fridays. Shoot, they might even try working on Saturdays and Sundays like some of us do to get the job done. Look, you know, this is critically important, and an extension is simply rewarding past failures. It is nothing more than that, and it creates great risk of Congress scooping the resources from direct payments, using it for deficit reduction or for something else, and not having adequate resources to craft a comprehensive and meaningful farm bill. That is a serious risk that we should not take. It does not solve the Brazilian cotton issue. It does not provide the certainty that producers and Jason's team at NRCS need to be able to make long-range plans and commitments. It does not maintain and allow us to maintain and add to the momentum and quicken the momentum that's out in the countryside with record farm income, record exports, record enrollment in conservation, record expansion of local and regional food systems, a record investment in the bio-based economy. It doesn't provide any of that. So an extension is an excuse, is just really sort of underscoring the failure of Congress to act. There's no reason why this can't be done. There's no reason why we couldn't have had a conference committee formed long ago. The Senate was prepared to do so. And what we have is the House leadership using SNAP as a foil for a larger conversation about entitlements and essentially delaying the discussion that needs to take place. So an extension is not the answer, I will tell you that we are very much opposed to the idea of an extension, and so is the Senate. That's just not going to happen.
Let's continue with our callers on the line. We have Jason Llewellyn, who is a retired TSP. Joseph.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. One of the issues that USDA and NRCS is having right now is outreach and dissemination of information. The Farm Bill withholding and all of the things that are going on that socially disadvantaged, historically underserved, don't have good access to quality information to make decisions on. And I wonder if there is a way that we can work that program so that we can get the information out a little bit better.
Well, I would say, and Jason can certainly add to this, NRCS has been an active participant and, in fact, leading the effort this year in a program we call Strike Force, which is now involved in 15 states across the United States. And it's really focused on providing assistance and help to areas of the country that has experienced persistent poverty, and using all of the USDA programs, including those in NRCS, to try to stimulate economic activity in those persistently poor areas and providing help and assistance to socially disadvantaged producers in those strike force areas. I can tell you that as a result of the work of Jason and his team at NRCS, we have seen in the strike force areas a significant increase, I think roughly a 62% increase in the applications that have been submitted by socially disadvantaged producers. So that is one vehicle for getting information out to producers, and that combined with a more concerted effort through our Beginning Farmer and Rancher Development Program, through Extension, through some of the councils that we've established with Native American farmers and ranchers, African American, Hispanic farmers and ranchers, we are working very hard to expand information about the technical assistance that's available. The last thing I would say is that that we have, despite the budget difficulties and challenges, looked for creative ways to increase the technical assistance capacity of NRCS with additional personnel. Obviously, NRCS has had to make some belt tightening, as we all have, but one of the areas that we seek to continue funding and continue to seek financing and increase financing is in the area of technical assistance.
So I would just add to that, Mr. Secretary, and to you, Joseph, NRCS, we're taking this charge very seriously, and so under the Secretary's leadership with the Strike Force Initiative, we really are very much focusing on this at the local level, but at the state level as well, providing additional resources, both on the technical assistance side, working with community-based organizations and agricultural associations to get out and to really provide that outreach and education, in many cases holding town hall meetings where we will send district conservationists and other conservationists to those meetings and actually hold sign-ups at those meetings. As people walk out the door, we can hopefully get them enrolled or at least sign up for a field visit. And also working with new organizations that we haven't really had a lot of history working with, but we're starting to get to know much better. Just recently was in Arkansas and met with folks from the East Arkansas Economics Corporation, and there they're partnering with University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff, and together it's a three-way partnership, also working with other USDA agencies and coming together and at the local level working with those socially disadvantaged producers and helping them essentially form co-ops where they're coming in, and through conservation assistance we're helping to install practices that will not only improve their yield but also improve the health of their soils and water resources so they have long-term economic and agronomic sustainability. But then also this corporation is helping them provide enhanced economic opportunities to sell the produce either locally or to Walmart, to large food chains in the region.
These states that are involved in Strike Force include Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, Arkansas, Alabama, New Mexico, Nevada, Colorado, Arizona, areas of the Dakotas as well. So it is a broad-based in many parts of the country, and we'll continue to work on these persistently poor areas in other states as well.
Let's continue with callers on the line. We've got Todd Epp with Northern Plains News, and he'll be followed by Gail Cunningham, who is with WYXY. Todd.
Thank you. Secretary Vilsack, probably a deceptively simple question about the farm bill, but what's the problem with passage? Is it Democrat versus Republican? Is it urban versus rural? I mean, what are the blocks that are opposing? What can be done to try to find a compromise to get the bill passed?
Well, I think this is unlike previous farm bills where the differences that you've alluded to were indeed the differences that had to be overcome but were easier to overcome. Traditionally and historically, farm bill discussions are not really so much Republican-Democrat as they are various commodity or regional differences between various commodities. That's not necessarily the case here. What we have here is a decision by the House of Representatives and its leadership to basically split off nutrition assistance programs from farm programs. Now, I happen to think that that's really a bad idea for a number of reasons, but most importantly, I think it diminishes the ability to get a bill done. It diminishes the ability of farm programs to get the kind of support they need to convince urban and suburban legislators and members of Congress to vote for a farm bill. And I think there may be some folks whose desire and interest is not only to reduce our commitment to struggling families who need nutrition assistance, but in fact to end our assistance and help to farm programs. So the big problem now is until the House of Representatives votes on a rather significant and deep cut to the SNAP program, totaling nearly $41 billion, they have not identified conferees to a conference committee to work out differences between a bill that was passed earlier by the House that didn't include nutrition and the comprehensive Senate bill that included all of the farm bill programs. So we will see next week, we're told, that they'll have a vote on the nutrition programs, and then they are promised to appoint conferees. If that happens, we'll see how quickly folks get to work. We at USDA are prepared to help and assist in those areas where there are differences in policy to work creatively to try to bridge those differences as quickly as possible so we get this work done and this bill in shape that it can pass the Senate and the House and be signed by the President. It will not contain a $40 billion reduction in SNAP. I honestly think the whole purpose of this exercise is to put a focus on entitlements without paying a political price if you were to raise issues concerning Medicare or Social Security. And I think people can see through that fairly quickly, and the Senate has indicated absolutely no interest whatsoever in a cut of that magnitude.
Let's continue with callers on the line. Let's go to Gail Cunningham with WYXY. Gail.
Thank you. Secretary Vilsack, as well as Chief Weller, I guess in the debate coming up between the SNAP and the Foundation Comprehensive Farm Bill, I hope that they realize that in this debate that Secretary Vilsack, the USDA, took huge cuts already preparing even prior to sequester, and then they continue on to chop away. And the Farm Bill is truly a year-by-year necessary for us as farmers and agriculturists here in the Midbelt. However, the natural resources conservation projects are much longer term. Is there a likelihood that in this debate, that in the cuts that may come, that the NRCS could very well take a bigger cut now than they've already taken in the new Farm Bill proposals?
Well, I think there's always a risk. When the focus is on deficit reduction, there's always a risk in any program that has significant resources committed to it that there be reductions. But I think of all the programs within the Farm Bill where there are significant resources, conservation probably has the broadest level of support. I think everyone understands the need to prevent soil erosion. You know, we are losing literally billions of tons of soil every single day, or every single year, rather, and we've seen a marked reduction of that soil erosion, but there's still work to be done. I think we lose about 1.5 billion tons a year. So there's still work to be done, even though we have seen improvements the last couple of years. And I think everybody wants that work to be done. Everybody wants quality water. Everybody wants cover crops and water retention and the carbon sequestration capacity of agriculture to be maximized. So I'm hopeful that we won't see significant reductions. And I'm also hopeful that there's a linkage between some of the support programs through crop insurance and conservation, that there's a compliance requirement that is sort of resumed or restored if we're to provide subsidies for crop insurance, so that there's a good deal for conservation in this Farm Bill.
Okay. Well, I think they just would add, Mr. Secretary and Gail, that yes, the cuts, I wouldn't necessarily prognosticate what the likelihood would be of cuts for conservation, but I can say in terms of the cuts we have experienced is starting to impact our ability to provide service in the field for farmers and ranchers. And so nationally, if you look at what our field force was and what it is today, we're hundreds of positions short. And what that means at the end of the day for farmers and ranchers is less ability to get in the field to provide timely service, to provide the conservation planning, and ultimately provide access to be able to participate in these Farm Bill conservation programs. And so we're doing what we can, the belt tightening, and are trying to become as efficient as possible and really maintain that level of service. But at the end of the day, it's been challenging in the current budget climate for sure.
And it doesn't provide the resources that we need to continue accelerating our streamlining effort, which hopefully will result in easier access for farmers and producers to conservation plans and the development of those plans, and making it a little bit easier for folks to work in the field without the necessity of always having to go back to the office and spend time doing that.
We have time for one last call. Jerry Hagstrom with the Hagstrom Report. Jerry.
Yes, Mr. Secretary, you said you were expecting a vote next week on the nutrition programs. I'm wondering if you have heard anything official from Congress on this, or if you're talking about this based on the news accounts.
Well, I read the Hagstrom Report on a regular basis, and I think I've gotten that information from the Hagstrom Report.
No, that I have not reported that, but other people have. I'm just curious.
Well, we have not received any formal notification, but in my discussions with Chairman Lucas and in my discussions with other members of the House, they have indicated to me that it is the plan for the House to take this up next week. Now, obviously, those plans can change depending upon circumstances, as we've seen most recently with a discussion of Syria, but I think there is a real desire, apparently, to get this nutrition bill on the floor and get it voted on. I sincerely hope that it gets defeated, and I sincerely hope that regardless of the outcome of that vote, The House then gets serious about getting this farm bill done, and to do that, they've got to get conferees appointed. There's really no reason why that can't be done today, or why it couldn't have been done a week ago, a month ago. But it is what it is, and we are going to continue to be prepared at a moment's notice to provide help and assistance to the extent we can to get this thing done.
Any closing remarks? That's it? All right. Well, everyone, thank you for joining us for our call, and it's concluded.